It's back on the job this morning following the longest hotel worker strike in the islands. Local 5 members ratified a new contract with Marriott early this week, which now raises the bar for negotiations at other hotel chains, Hilton and Hyatt. Those contracts expired this summer. Union leader Eric Gill sat down with us after a marathon session of bargaining this week to reflect on the gains which were hammered out in the agreement.
When we say one job should be enough, you know, we're making it's an economic statement, meaning, you know, we demand that this industry that's rolling in money right now, just generating billions of dollars and given this huge tax break at the public expense by Congress earlier in the year, you know, there's hundreds of millions of dollars there. And what about us? You know, so this was the time for us to make a bid for one job should be enough. This is the time when the industry that employs us can afford to give big raises. And so, you know, and one job should be enough is not just, of course, on the salaries and the wage line, but, you know, you have to have good medical for your family. You know, if you don't have good insurance, you know, your paycheck can be rapidly eroded by medical costs, retirement. Of course, you know, we work hard. We want to have a chance to retire and be able to help our grandkids as opposed to be a burden to them. You know, these are generally one job should be enough issues. And when you think it through, one job should be enough is just a new way of saying the historic fight of the working class, if you will. And American workers led the world in the fight for the 8-hour day 100 years ago and won and created an 8-hour day and created overtime and created weekends and all the things that we now come to think of as you know, our time, people's time.
Right. What's a weekend? I know we've heard that line. What's a weekend, right?
Right. But if you have 3 jobs, a weekend is a time for your second and third job, you know, and you don't get time with your family and you don't have a chance to go to a public hearing or get involved in the PTA or become a big brother or anything that, you know, that contributes to community. You know, if workers have no time to do any of that, then the community suffers, and not just economically, but it suffers from, I mean, who's going to coach the softball team so that the neighbor's kid can, you know, can go out for sports? You know, all those things depend on people having some time for a life.
I was struck by something that was said on the line on Sunday. Some of the clergy were out there. They said, you know, a lot of you folks have roots, the sugar plantation days. You know, you folks are hard workers, and you hold down multiple jobs. And I just was wondering how many folks maybe picked up additional hours because they were on strike.
Oh, well, many, many of them, obviously. You know, I mean, people can't just lose all their livelihood for 2 months and laugh it off. I mean, we were able to, you know, we had accumulated a fair amount of cash, right, in preparation for this and whatever else we face. And so we had enough money in our strike fund to provide, you know, decent benefits, you know, something to help people get by while we're on strike. But many of them did find more hours on their second job. And frankly, some of their second employers were quite happy about that. And I'm sure others, you know, found additional work out there, either, you know, regular jobs or casual work of some sort. So workers are creative about surviving. That's what we do.
Did you have folks cross the line?
A few. I mean, you know, there were agencies sending scabs in, you know, and, you know, that's one thing. And it's another thing for our own union members to basically, you know, thumb their nose at the rest of us and go to work. A very small number, fortunately, which I think is a good thing for everyone at this point. There's going to be some strong feelings about those things.
What happens to the employees that were banned from certain properties, I think on Maui and I think even here on Oahu?
Banned? Somebody got banned? I never heard of that, and it's not happening.
It's not happening, so they're all reporting to work.
Look, everyone, all of those things, you know, we settled all those things. You know, I mean, they're a product of the strike, and look, at some point, you know, we can fight with the boss, and we do. You know, we're not ashamed or reticent about it. We'll fight the boss when we have to, but the truth is most of our interests are the same with the hotel. If the hotel does well, we can get more money. We can make more money. If the hotel isn't doing well, we all hurt. And so, you know, when it's time to settle a strike, it's time to settle out those other things. What's the point of the company buying labor peace and then just leaving an open wound. And so, you know, the company did the right thing. It was tough. There were some of these cases they felt strongly about, but at the end of the day, we weren't going to leave anyone behind, so everybody's going back to work.
Is there anything that you're particularly proud of with this contract?
My members. You know, look, you know, this has been a transformative experience, Catherine. The everybody on that picket line was changed in a good way for it. You know, they people who never, you know, just said hi, walking past each other all these years, you know, divided up by departments, they were there together every day, you know, learning about each other, you know, the divisions within us, you know, there's divisions with any group, you know, and, you know, there, some of them are artificial, kind of like imposed by management. You're a housekeeper, you're a wait help, you're a, you know, you're something else. And some of them are like in our society, you know, we have divisions between locals and immigrants, between different groups of people, you know, men and women. We have all those things. This strike reminded everybody of how much we need each other and how much we benefit by being together and working together. And it gives people a taste of the potential power that the working class has, if only we can overcome all these divisions that are put upon us. You know, that's why the billionaires are pushing anti-immigration stuff. That's why they're whipping up racism. That's why they're trying to divide people. That's why they're supporting sex harassers, you know, because they want working people to be divided along those social fault lines. But we've swept those away, and that's a huge thing. And I think it's the hope, not just for us, but for society. You know, our society is deeply divided, and if working people can figure out who's on their side and who's not, and gather all of the people on our side, which is the vast majority, then we can sweep away those racism and sexism and all those divisive crap that the wealthy in our society use to divide us so they can continue to pick our pockets.
Did you think that any of the gains that you made, whether it be the panic button or getting the raises, or rolling back on some of the quotas, any of those in particular you thought maybe you weren't going to get?
We didn't know we would get any of those things. You know, the company from the start said, no, we're not going to agree on a room drop. You know, it's expensive. And it's expensive for several reasons. You know, I'll just stick on that one because I'm proud of that one. When you take a, you know, a hotel with 1,000 rooms and you say that each housekeeper is going to do 14 instead of 15, that means they have to hire a dozen more people. We just created several dozen new jobs, good jobs, and better jobs now than they were a month ago because of these raises and stuff. So we've created more employment for the people of Hawaii, more money here in our community left by these global corporations that are scooping the gold off our beaches and taking it off to make profit somewhere else. So, you know, that alone created jobs. You know, our raises fix more money from the hotels into our local economy. That creates jobs as well. You know, the person on the corner store where we buy our, you know, buy our beer, or, you know, the guy in the car, the car lot when we go in for a new car, you know, those people get employment when we get a raise. You know, so we're very conscious of the fact that we are the agency, the tool of the people of Hawaii in making sure that some of the wealth from our beaches and, you know, those things that we sacrifice that used to be just for locals and now they're for tourists, we got to get something out of that and not just be pushed into slums and be used as servants for outside. We're proud people here in Hawaii, and we deserve better. In one of our caucuses, you know, I had proposed that we do a housing fund to help drive that. The majority of our committee felt that we should put, you know, whatever resources we could into, you know, helping people with child care and elder care, both of which, are, you know, depending on how old you are, our members are faced with difficulties in both those, you know, the younger ones with their kids and the older ones with their parents. And so...
So the trust fund really took a back seat then to
well,
those issues.
Well, we now have a trust fund for that, right. You know, and we'll work out the housing thing. The mortgage program doesn't require us to do that. We can expand that. Going into this, I really didn't see how we would be able to wrap our arms around the notion of technology and that stuff. You know, I mean, of course, the raises and securing a medical, you know, that goes without saying, but some of these other things are a little less obvious. you know, we're facing a situation where the government is just subsidizing, paying people to build these robots and learn how to, and every 6 months they can do things they couldn't do before. If they can build a robot soldier, they can build a robot housekeeper. And they are, you know. So we're getting apps, you know, just like when I check in on the airline, they have an app now that I can get my room key on my phone and hold it up to that little plate on the door, and I don't have to see a front desk clerk. I can go, you know, they're bragging about it. You can go from the plane to your room. And we need to slow the boss down long enough to talk to us and work stuff out with us when it affects people's jobs. And that's not what's been happening. You know, some bright-eyed engineer somewhere in the corporate headquarters comes up and pitches his idea, and they adopt it, and they roll out a program. Right. And by the time we find out about it, we got layoffs. So we're not in a position, nor do we believe that we can stop or even significantly slow technology. We need to slow the companies down so that they take the interests of workers into account before they roll these things out. So we now have a program that makes them do that. They have to notify us. We're going to establish we have to hire some experts, and we're doing that, you know, on an international basis. We're going to share that. No sense every local hire tech experts. We'll share a resource. You know, they have to come and talk to us. They have to show us the plan. We have to establish the impact on workers. You know, we have to be able to bargain, you know, from some position of strength. So we've built some bargaining programs in there. We have to be able to assess the impact on workers so that we can protect our jobs. You know, if a housekeeper is using a vacuum robot instead of a regular vacuum, that's still our work. And I mean, you know, and operating that robot is our work. We have to be able to keep that, not some geek in the IT office doing that. You know, we have to have a program to retrain people, because there's going to be people to get squeezed out.
And all that you're able to get in this contract?
Yeah, we actually, you know, on a national union basis between the basic 8 cities that were on strike, we now have an agreement with Marriott that kind of goes through those general headings and gives some specifics. It's the first, you know, we looked all over. We couldn't find anything in any union contract. So this may be the first tech proposal like of its kind in the country. And we're happy and anxious to share that with other unions and others. You know, it's a problem that many, many industries are going to face.
That was Local 5's Eric Gill reflecting on the settlement of this labor dispute. Now, of the 8 cities that United Here targeted, the only remaining Marriott properties that are out on strike are in San Francisco, where Gill says health care costs are a big challenge. This is The Conversation on Stay White member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Every city, town, or suburb across America has its holiday traditions, and in Hawaii there are many, large and small, that let us feel how this season sets us apart from others. Lights play an especially important role in holiday displays. They're beautiful, captivating, and are often a metaphor for the inner light and warmth of the season many of the holidays represent. And for many years, the city and county of Honolulu routinely flexes its holiday cheer to make a big statement about December celebrations. Oahu residents and visitors will often include a special trip downtown to see the extravagantly decorated trees or pay a visit to Santa and check out the annual holiday wreath contest. Today, it's not just Honolulu that lights up the streets. Cities across the state have been decorating their streets with their favorite Christmas characters. And we wondered, how far back does this tradition of lighting does the city go? Well, do you know that the year of the first Honolulu city lights? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Brian Diedrich from Hawaii Opera Theater, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Palihua Wind. It was during the Thanksgiving week that Hawaiian Electric announced it reached an agreement to purchase power from Euros Energy America under a deal involving land owned by the family of former Lieutenant Governor Tom Gill. Councilwoman Kimberly Pine released a statement yesterday afternoon expressing her concerns about the project. Earlier in the day, we'd sat down in our studios with Tony Gill and Hawaiian Electric's Peter Rozek to talk about the project. We start off with Euros Vice President Nick Hendrickson, who joined us for the conversation from San Diego.
The project itself is 13 wind turbines. It's located on a ridge above the Kahe power plant. It's going to be approximately 47 megawatts total. It'll produce about 150,000 megawatt hours of electricity on an annual basis, which is approximately the energy use that about 25,000 homes on Oahu use on an annual basis. And that represents about 3% of Oahu's total energy demand. We're happy that it's one of the lowest priced renewable energy projects to date for the state, and we're happy to be working with HECO to make it a success going forward.
Can you talk about the technology that you're using? How different will these wind turbines be from what we see either at Kahuku or anywhere else across the state?
These turbines that we're anticipating for the project are going to be 3.6 megawatt machines. They're going to be manufactured by one of the leading manufacturers in the world of wind turbines, a company called Vestas out of Denmark. They are going to be approximately 260 feet from the base of the tower to the hub, kind of the middle of the rotor. They're going to look similar to the turbines that you typically see both in the North Shore or elsewhere. The design of the turbines generally has kind of, from an appearance standpoint, has stayed pretty stable. They will be state-of-the-art, so there's been a variety of technological improvements in turbine technology over the last, 10 years that allow them to be more efficient at gathering the wind resource, more quiet, and just generally better for the purposes that we're using them for. But generally, they will look similar, to most eyes, to the turbines that you've seen in the North Shore and elsewhere.
Will there be any battery storage?
As of now, we're not anticipating any battery storage for the current agreement we have with HECO, but it's something that we could entertain if it's of interest going forward. But the current project does not anticipate any battery storage.
I bring that up because we did have that fire over in Kahuku.
You know, the technology's come a long way. That one was much more of an experimental nature, and I think things have come a long way since then. As Nick said, these are going to be state-of-the-art and the best technology available. In general, battery storage, energy storage has come a long way within just the last few years. 13 turbines is not going to obscure very much. And when we say the ridge over Kahe, they're not all going to be up on the very precipice of the ridge. There, you get to the top of the valley there, and then the land goes back in these rolling hills for some distance. So there will be some turbines visible without doubt, but this is not going to be one of those kind of forests of wind turbines like you might see. Even in California, there's some fairly dense wind farms, but this won't be like it. It'll be much more, I think, visible, like Kahuku, frankly. You can see a couple as you drive around. You see them from different angles, but can't pretend that they're not there, but they're not going to be a major factor in terms of visibility.
And Tony Gill, can you talk about the reason why your family is involved in this?
From our point of view, this is not an energy project. This is an ecosystem restoration project using energy sales as the financial keystone. to do what we need to do to reverse 300 years of devastation.
And what's caused that devastation?
Oh, Lordy, that's a long discussion. If I had the opportunity to go back and be the helpful guy from the future and tell King Kamehameha to kapu the cattle differently, I would have done so. But all of the islands have suffered tremendous destruction from hoofed creatures, deforestation, cutting for sailing ships, sandalwood harvest, and so forth on down the line.
And what's the acreage up there?
Property is about 1,600 acres, give or take. And we have two kinds of situations to deal with. One is second growth forest put in by wise foresters trying to stop the erosion back in the early 1900s. And below that, there's continuing pasture land, which is pretty beat.
How do you stop the erosion with this project?
Well, anything that you do on land like that requires a lot of hand work, a lot of labor. If you're going to talk about reforestation, ask around, find out anybody who's tried to plant trees in the afternoon sun. There are jobs to be done, but they take generations to do, and people can't volunteer to do this. We can do some of the pioneering work, and we're very happy with our partnerships with Malama Learning Center, their outreach to even Kapolei High School, some university people, even HECO people have come up to take a look at this, and we're in the early stages of figuring out how to do it. But in order to go large, we need to hire people, clearly. If you're going to try to restore a Hawaiian forest in an area that's as devastated as this, your first job is to stop fire, because otherwise you spend a generation and it's gone in an afternoon. We've had several major fires in the last couple of years. People from that area will remember for sure. We have to create appropriate forestry roads, water. We have to create fences so that we can move the existing cattle as appropriate. We have to find a balance between the cattle that we have to eat down the grass that causes the fire load, be able to move them correctly so they don't overgraze. We have to be able to move people, trucks and planting equipment up and down. We have to create all kinds of things, fences, roads, erosion controls to stop what's washing away now, and so forth. A lot of detail work.
Catherine, I just want to say, I think we're very lucky here in Hawaii to have a family like the Gill family that has a lifetime and a multi-generational commitment to the environment here, that's willing to do work that will not pay off or not even begin to break even for perhaps a generation or more. The saying is the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time is today. And that's what this family is committed to doing. And that's why for us, it's a very welcome project. There's a lot of Hawaiian Electric facilities out on the Leeward Coast, as you know. And anytime we can be part of giving back to that community particularly, but to the whole island really. And there are just not that many organizations, institutions, families, or whatever that are willing to have that kind of long-range look, to look down to the next generation and the generation after that. So I think we're very, very fortunate to have a family like this that is willing to not just talk about the environment, but literally get their hands dirty with it.
We've seen on the North Shore with the Kahuku project, there was some pushback because I think that proposal, the most recent one, had very large turbines, I think 600 feet or so, and the community's just kind of processing the visual blight, and then also the issues about the native bat, the birds. The take is much larger than anybody expected.
There are always going to be trade-offs in any renewable project, whether it's solar, whether it's wind, whether it's geothermal, no question. And, I don't blame the Kahuku folks for a minute for being concerned about their community. The fact is, if we're going to get to 100% renewable energy here in the islands by 2045, we're going to have to do two things. One is to give up a little bit of our NIMBYism, and we're going to have a portfolio, not just one kind. We've been dependent on one source of energy for a long time. It's worked out till fairly recently, but now we've got to diversify, and wind has got to be there, solar's got to be there, biofuels, geothermal where it's available. And if the community doesn't want to go there, then they have to raise that issue with the legislature that passed the law and so forth. But we just got a huge report about climate change that should have scared the bejesus out of pretty much anybody. And what can we do about it here? We can get to renewable energy as fast as we can, and that's what this project is part of.
And Nick, can you talk about what you folks might be doing to minimize the take on the native bat and the native birds?
Yeah, so we've been trying to be pretty proactive about that. I know some of the issues that have come up on the projects on the North Shore came up relatively recently. As a result of kind of what we've learned and with the local environmental folks that we're working with to study the project that have also been involved in some of the studies recently on the North Shore, we've already started monitoring for bats at the site using telemetry devices that essentially listen for bat vocalizations or bat noises, if you will. So we've already been doing a substantial amount of data analysis and gathering at the site to try to figure out what's the best way for us to minimize any potential impacts to the bats or any other species of concern going forward.
And Tony, I don't know, what's your family's experience been? Have you seen bats up there?
Very few. I'd like to address Pete's point, though, if I might. People ask us, why wind? Isn't the thing big? And the answer is, yeah, they're big in proportion to the problem we're trying to solve. The people who are aware of what's coming and the severe challenges that the entire globe faces, the serious thinkers, not just people who have some irresponsible opinion, realize that we have very few choices. As a practical matter right now, we could choose to go with wind where it's available, and it is available there, and it's a good wind site. But the point I'd want to make is we can make enough power out of 13 turbines with probably less than an acre or two of footprint than you could with a very superior solar design that took up the entire populated area of Nanakuli Valley. And I'm not just talking roofs, I'm talking houses, driveways, schools. That's how efficient this is. And so a person who says, why wind, isn't it big? I say, yeah, it's big. The problem is big. The solution has to be proportionate. But what we are avoiding by doing this is paving over an area equivalent to the inhabited area of Nanakuli Valley with solar cells. So I think that's a reasonable trade. If you think that it's a trade not worth making, then it's somebody's obligation to say where that should go. What lovely, flat, ho'opili-like area should now be covered with solar cells in lieu of this? Bear in mind, it's a 2% to 3% contribution. The scale of the problem is immense on Oahu.
I guess there are varying communities who see these things springing up, whether it's massive utility scale solar farms like we have on the Waianae Coast, I think it's the Euros project there, or it's going vertical with the wind turbines.
Well, I wish I could tell you that in 1970 we had worked carefully to slowly cut off the use of oil and transformed ourselves, but we didn't. And so realistic people will deal with what we have on the ground today. Hawaiian Electric has done a very good job with their PSIP, and people should read it if they're interested.
PSIP?
Power Supply Improvement Plan, which is our overall plan for getting all of the islands in our service territory to 100% renewable by 2045. It's a plan, and it won't be exact, but it points the direction and says we have to have projects like this, we have to have the solar areas that are going into Waianae, Central Oahu, North Shore, couple others on the neighbor islands. We have to do a lot. We hope to be at 30%. We will be at 30% of the milestone we're supposed to reach by 2020. But as you get closer and closer to the ultimate goal, it gets harder and harder. So this is a very substantial contribution. It's the last untapped viable wind resource on this island. This island has the huge population, all of the infrastructure of government and so forth, and rather limited opportunities for renewables of any kind. And so we can't depend on the neighbor islands either. We can't just say, let's put it all on Maui or the Big Island or Lanai or Molokai. We know that isn't going to fly. Every island, every neighborhood has to do its part, and it happens that with the North Shore and Kahuku, this is a wonderful wind resource, and it's no question it's going to be, you know, not everybody's going to love it, but after it's built and in service for a couple of years, I don't think people will say, oh, it's awful. It'll be just part of the landscape, and not an ugly part, I got to say. I mean, not everybody's a fan of wind turbines, but I think they're kind of majestic and beautiful, you know, slowly, you know, ramping around in the wind, you know, they're getting us to a place where we need to go.
Unless you happen to be a bat, I guess. I guess maybe it's the lesser of the evils, you know. Is it?
What choices do you really have?
Right, exactly.
Question.
Exactly. Yeah. Do you have a Kahi power plant with oil?
What do you want to do? Because right. if you're right. going to go off oil, you have two realistic choices right now, wind and solar. We don't have any obvious way to get to the 100% we've said we will.
And what we haven't mentioned is this is the price of this is really very, very attractive for Oahu customers. It is among the lowest, if not the lowest, in the state for per kilowatt hour of renewable energy. And, you know, that's a benefit that every single person on Oahu will appreciate and enjoy. So it is not just that it's a good project and a good place for a good cause. We're getting it at what for a customer is a bargain. So in that respect, we just see it as a win-win-win kind of project, notwithstanding the birds and the bats and...
Well, we're going to make more birds.
Okay. Well, and no, that's a good point. The Kahuku property, the developer there has offset the kill or the take with a donation to land, I think, that they're protecting in central Oahu.
We're going to, if we succeed in reconstructing something like a Hawaiian forest, we're going to expand our population of the native birds in the uplands. We're going to restore water inflow to the soil, which is currently put into the atmosphere by the eucalyptus species. We're going to protect the archaeology that we value. We've done original work up there that nobody else has reproduced anywhere.
Councilmember Kim Pine's reservations are about how the project might affect archaeological sites at Palihua Ridge, specifically a rock formation called a pa, used as a star guide in Hawaiian culture. Pine's office said the community raised the cultural concerns at a recent neighborhood board meeting, which had not been addressed in any follow-up, and so were caught by surprise by the recent announcement. Uros and the Gill family said they're committed that both the wind farm and reforestation needs to be respectful of those sites. The project will need environmental and cultural reviews, and Uros says it will work to address community concerns. The deal still needs approval from the Public Utilities Commission and will involve public input. If PUC approvals come next year, the project could be up by 2022.
Amanda Frazier and the Keepers won a Hoku Award for Alternative Album of the Year. They bring their original music in the folk pop style to HPR's Atherton Studio on December 1st. Reserve your seats now at hprtickets.org or by calling the station during business hours. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Why don't you lay your head down, child? It is now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. On the line with us this morning, reporter Nathan Eagle with a story about an idea to encourage greener cars, trucks, and buses on our roads. Morning.
Good morning.
So, yeah, tell us about this.
So this has kind of got kick-started Tuesday when the State Climate Commission unanimously voted to back legislation next session, which of course starts in January, to develop some kind of carbon tax, a carbon fee, or even as Representative Chris Lee put it, a pollution fee. So regardless of what kind of semantics are going to be at play, it's basically a tax is what they're looking at as a way of charging folks who are using fossil fuels that, you know, the vast majority of scientists say are really, really harming our planet. So the goal is to make our ground transportation sector a lot greener, faster.
Okay, so how do we do this? How do we roll something like this out?
So I think it would start with the legislature, which they convene again next January. It would be some kind of bill. The Climate Commission didn't specify the language in that bill. They managed to get all 22 members to agree on the concepts. And then they just kind of gave some broad parameters, like, you know, it should be equitable and things like that. It should minimize regressiveness. But they're going to leave it in the hands of state lawmakers. So we'll really be watching them to see what they want to do with it.
And I know we've already seen Honolulu City and County roll out those electric buses on our streets. They're trying them out. I think they're trying it out over at the state airport as well.
That's right. Yeah, I think we could see a lot more of that. We might see more charging stations. We might see more efforts to just make it easier to walk around town, bike around town, and otherwise burn less fossil fuels.
It is, though. Well, it's a tax or a pollution fee or whatever you want to call it. So that's obviously a pocketbook issue that I know some folks aren't going to be comfortable with, but it isn't an election year anymore, I think, as we go into next year, right?
Absolutely. So in that sense, it definitely works in the favor for lawmakers. You know, it's an off year for them. Governor Ige is going to be starting his first part of his second term, so nothing to really worry about there. But there's absolutely going to be a lot of pushback on this because it is extra money coming out of our pocket, already the highest cost of living in the state. And, of course, there's tons of other competing priorities, you know, education, homelessness, all these other things that people want to see extra funds go towards. So it'll be quite a discussion to watch.
Right. And then you and I were at that news conference earlier with the mayor and Josh Stambro, the sustainability officer, and Chip Fletcher, and, you know, other scientists who were involved in this report that came out about climate change and where we're headed and the things we need to do.
Absolutely. Those are going to be some of the key players, key voices, key experts. There's no disagreement, it seems, at this point anymore that this is something we absolutely have to do. It's more the question of how do we get there? What is soon? What does that mean to some folks compared to other folks?
Right. And so you've got this climate commission saying, okay, we support this state carbon tax, and then we'll see how the public reacts, I guess, when we get to the public hearings in January.
We will, yes. As Suzanne Case put it, the one of the chairs of the Climate Commission, you know, what they did was make a really powerful statement by unanimously agreeing to this. So, yeah, we'll be watching them.
So any other pushback that you see coming with this? Like you said, we've got lots of competing demands.
Right. Well, you know, in Hawaii, which is super, super blue, there's not a lot of that voice of climate denial and that kind of thing. I think the pushback is going to come more from it's a money question. You know, can we in this highest cost of living state afford this, basically? And of course, you'll see folks on the other side saying, how can we afford not to do this?
Okay. All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's reality check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
People have been tear-gassed at the Mexican border, in Ferguson, Missouri, in Cairo, Egypt.
Will this gas really make you cry?
This Egyptian demonstrator picked up a tear gas canister labeled Made in the USA.
I thought it was called tear gas. I had no idea it was called choke you to death and run around blindly gas.
We visit one small Pennsylvania town where tear gas is made on the world.
This afternoon at 1.
Many of us have grown up with the annual trip to the Honolulu City Lights event every year. And you likely have a few stories of your own, perhaps so do your parents and grandparents, because the first large display of holiday lights happened quite a while ago. We wanted to find out exactly when and what was on view for the first city lights display. So we asked you, and we also checked with the Bishop Museum archives. By today's standards, the display wasn't large or elaborate, since it only extended for a few blocks on Fort Street, which was then Honolulu's main shopping spot and home to the largest and best stores. And the lights really were just that, strings of large colored light bulbs draped from one side of the street to the other. In successive years, downtown streets got involved, and the A'ala Merchants Association, a group of Japanese business owners with establishments on the Makai side of King Street, across from A'ala Park, joined in as well. With the exception of the Second World War years of 1941 through 1944 and the energy crisis late in 1973, which made the energy gobbled up by Christmas display seem wasteful, we've had a glowing tradition of Honolulu holiday lights since December 1938. And you may catch many city light festivities throughout the state this weekend. Just check your local city website. That is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. No one got today's question. Much attention was given to American troops deployed to the U.S.-Mexico border over the Thanksgiving holiday. But at the same time, military personnel from Hawaii and Guam were also mobilized for another deployment, one that received much less attention. HPR's Ryan Finnerty tells us about the disaster response effort still underway in the Northern Marianas Islands.
Oh! Great. The ceiling just collapsed.
Imagine winds strong enough to overturn a car. That's what residents of Saipan and Tinian experienced last October when Super Typhoon Yutu made landfall with 180-mile-an-hour winds. Social media video from Saipan showed snapped tree trunks, roofs blown off houses, and torrential rains. Some of the first people to respond to the disaster were U.S. Army Reserve soldiers who live and work on the island.
Watching from the second floor, I could see how strong the winds were. And just from my experience, I've never seen a car flip over from wind before. Never been to a hurricane, never been to a tornado, but what I saw was pretty, it was a new experience.
That was First Lieutenant Bruce Camacho. He lives on the north side of Saipan. On a normal day, Bruce works in the office of the governor of the Northern Marianas Islands. But once a month, he puts on a uniform for duty as an officer in the storied 100th Infantry Battalion. As soon as it was safe to go outside, Lieutenant Camacho reported for disaster response duty.
It was chaos. Shelters were full capacity even before the storm hit. So when the storm actually hit and it took away a lot of concrete houses, there was a lot of displaced families that were looking for homes. When we got activated, we went straight to work alongside with the Saipan Mayor's Office and the Department of Public Works. We went straight into clearing the roads so FEMA and Red Cross could come in and help the people provide tents and household relief. In my role, I have about roughly 40 to 50 soldiers working under me. We conduct route clearances to clear primary and secondary roads to and from heavily populated villages such as Coblerville, San Antonio, Cagman, and a few other villages. We have a few LMTVs, military vehicles. We use them to transport metal and heavy debris to and from the villages. From day one, it's been really bad. I see people walking the streets. I see displaced families. As we start to clear these roads, little by little, week after week, I start to see a big change in housing. I see FEMA tents up. They're in much better state than they were 30 days ago, pretty much. And that's thanks to our federal and local agencies that work hand-in-hand with us. We're slowly improving. I think the challenges, too, is working long days and long nights. But we'll get through this. Like the saying goes, we're one Marianas.
There are only about 90 Army Reserve soldiers on Saipan, not nearly enough to deal with the damage from U-2. Within days, military flights were able to land and reinforcements were on the ground from FEMA, the Guam National Guard, and Hawaii. One of those mobilized was Sergeant Florence Yangelmau. She's originally from Saipan, but now lives and works on Oahu as a Department of Defense police officer. She said there was no hesitation when the order came to deploy.
To me personally, it was kind of emotional because I saw a lot of friends and families' houses, which was torn apart and damaged. There's a lot of debris on the road, and a lot of people's personal property was pretty bad. But a lot of people here are like coming together as a community, and they're just moving their stuff in the side of the road so that we can pick up the debris and take it to the dump site. Most of the damage is down on the south side, and it's really different from how it was before. There's no roofs on some of the housing. Some of the buildings, their concrete structures were broken down. A lot of houses, it's not even there at all. There's like holes. I saw a lot of holes in a lot of people's houses as well. I guess being struck down by a tree and whatnot that's in the surrounding areas. Even the trees here, they're no longer like standing straight. They're all sideways. When the wind was blowing, it was pretty hard, so they're all leaning towards the right.
Sergeant Yangelmau said that her hometown of San Vicente fared better than other parts of the island, but residents are still struggling.
Some parts of it is actually still okay. The only problem is that the lighting, there's no light because I guess the power lines have got down. As far as the water as well, there's no water. The city water is not pumping water there because there's a lot of damage to the pipes, the water pipes. So they're currently fixing the water pipes as well as putting up telephone poles to assist with the lighting. My family, currently, they do not have power. They're running off of generators. My mother-in-law's house was damaged. She's still pending FEMA to come over to look at her house to do an inspection. They don't have running water, nor do they have power at this time. They're very thankful to FEMA. They're thankful to the Red Cross, to the military, because we're coming here and basically helping our brothers and sisters. And they see that we do care, and we're doing our best to give them a positive attitude and a positive light that we're all one family.
Colonel Travis Delk is overseeing the more than 500 military personnel currently on Saipan. He normally works full-time at Fort Shafter in Honolulu, but was deployed to Saipan when the relief effort began. He arrived just 5 days after the storm made landfall.
The commercial airport was shut down for commercial flights due to the heavy devastation and damage specifically to the airport. The southern portion of the island, which was greatly damaged, much more so than the northern portion of the island. But for military air traffic at the airport, that opened up relatively soon, but commercial air traffic could not because the tower was identified as inoperable. The power was out. The flight line, many of the lights were knocked down. The airport sustained a large amount of damage. But it's operational now, slowly becoming more so and more so operational on the commercial side. Shortly after the disaster, military aircraft were flying in with Department of Defense personnel, military personnel, to aid the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, in the disaster recovery effort. When I arrived, I saw large amounts of devastation. Fence lines were blown down, trees, branches all in the road, debris, roofs, people's houses blown off. In some cases, completely, the roofs completely blown off their properties and houses. It looked in many ways like a huge kind of like a bomb went off. The impact was very reflective of large scale devastation throughout, especially the southern portion of the island. Telephone lines down, power lines down, power poles crossing the road, and things of that nature. Incrementally, though, everything's been getting better and better. We're actually looking for the Department of Defense to minimize its footprint here in the coming days to kind of transfer more of the existing disaster response activities over to the local people and the contractors and assist them to be able to get their economy running again so that they can get back on their feet.
Colonel Delk said that utilities are coming back online, but housing is still a major challenge.
Our most enduring mission here will be the temporary housing and sheltering mission. Pretty much everybody on Saipan, so approximately 58,000 people here, were impacted in one way, shape, form, or another. There's assessment of over 1,000 people residing in the shelters. We're trying, FEMA's trying to actually repair certain, depending on the damage of the roof or the house, actually repair the roof. And then the priority, as designated by the government, is to get the personnel who are currently residing in shelters, get them a place to stay in, you know, repair their house and roof. Then if we can't do that quick enough, that they'll be afforded a tent. And to get those over 1,000 people out of shelters back into their homes. So it's definitely, Saipan's definitely not 100% normal to its pre-storm condition by any stretch, but every day it's a little bit better.
If the recovery continues as planned, most of the soldiers from Hawaii will return home in mid-December. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And you can see photos of the military's relief efforts on Tinian and Saipan on our Instagram page. Check it out at The Conversation, HPR, or on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we talk oysters, and we'll tell you about a new addition to the lawn fronting the Hawaii State Library. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave us a comment. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.